Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Stories with a universal appeal. That's the mission of Marquee Media. Based in Durham, North Carolina, the company is behind award-winning documentaries that focus on critical but often overlooked stories of the American South and beyond. Marquee Media's founder, director, and producer, Cynthia Hill, is my guest today. She is the recipient of a 2014 Peabody Award and the recipient of a 2015 Daytime Emmy for Best Director of a Lifestyle Culinary Travel Program for A Chef's Life, her first television series. It's been broadcast on PBS since 2013. Her documentaries include Private Violence, which tells the story of two domestic abuse survivors. It aired on HBO in 2014 and won a whole bunch of awards, including the Candescent Award at Sundance in 2014. There's also Tobacco Money Feeds My Family, broadcast on PBS in 2004. The Guest Worker, 2006, about migrant farm workers in North Carolina, and February 1, about the Greensboro, North Carolina lunch sit-ins during the 1960s. It was shown on PBS in 2004. Cynthia's latest documentary series is the 8-part Road to Race Day, which offers a behind-the-scenes look at the world of NASCAR racing told through the people who make it happen. Let's meet this born and bred North Carolinian who attended the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and hoped to be a pharmacist. Cynthia, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sandy. Thanks for having me.
So I read you grew up in Pink Hill, North Carolina, which is apparently a largely agricultural community, and that most of your family members were tobacco farmers. But apparently you chose a different path.
I did. I didn't realize how much I wanted to get away from that area. But by the time I finished high school and was off to college, I was very happy to spread my wings and to figure out what else was going on in the world. From an area like Pink Hill, and there's very few, it appears to be very few opportunities for women. And you're either steered towards teaching or nursing or something like that. But pharmacy was one of those careers that was also open to women. And the pharmacist in my community was probably the most respected individual in town. And to my understanding, probably made the most money. So I thought that that's what I wanted to be, was the pharmacist. And so I set off to be a pharmacist, and I still am a pharmacist. I haven't worked very much this year. I think I've worked 2 days this year at Walmart. It gives me that security blanket that I need to be able to take a lot of risks, because I know that I can always go back and do that if I have to. And it really has given me a lot of flexibility and permission to experiment.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense that that's what you have kind of under your belt. So tell me, how did you transition into the world of documentaries?
Well, it's a sort of bizarre story.
Oh, I love bizarre stories.
It is really bizarre. So I was in pharmacy school at UNC, and I was bartending because I was always working. So it was my one of my last years of pharmacy school, and I met this crew that was in Chapel Hill to film one of those accident recreation shows that was really popular in the early 90s. And they were there for like a month filming stuff. And so I befriended these folks from LA, and it was just fascinating meeting these people doing TV. And I ended up going out to LA that next summer just to hang out with these people, and took an affinity to the industry for some strange reason, and learned a couple of skills while I was out there. I was working in a pharmacy and also doing audio on the side for this production company out there. And I don't know, it was sort of one of those things. When I landed in that world, it felt like it was something I was supposed to do. I can't really explain it, but it was definitely a calling that I did not know that was even out there calling me. It was fortuitous that I was there at bartending and I met these folks, because my path totally changed because of that.
So you pick up and you go to LA. Did they promise you quote, employment?
I was following a boy.
Oh, you were following? Okay. But at the very least, did you experience some culture shock?
Of course. You know, I was this very inexperienced young lady from rural part of Eastern North Carolina with a really thick accent still at the time, out in LA, and I didn't know what I had landed into. It was kind of, I was shocked to say the least, but I also was wide-eyed and really curious and meeting all these different people and seeing that not everybody's the same. I already experienced that a little bit going off to college, but I was still in North Carolina, so this really was a whole new world for me. I had not traveled outside of North Carolina before then, you know, except, you know, the surrounding states. And so it was a very unique experience, to say the least. And it set me on this path to do this work.
But I don't mean to keep dwelling on this, but as I'm listening to you and I'm kind of internalizing all of this, I think that takes a lot of balls. Not that you grew up in a very sheltered environment, but like you said, your world was rather confined. And I can't imagine what you had inside of you to say, I'm gonna do this, following a boy notwithstanding. And also, how did this play out with your family?
I look back now and I see this tendency in me to be really naive. And I jump without really thinking a lot. Looking back, they definitely are calculated risks that I take. But I am definitely one of those folks that likes to take risks. And so going off to LA was, it was a short engagement, so it didn't seem like a major commitment or anything like that. I wasn't packing up my bags and moving out
there. So you were passing through, kind of. I mean, you weren't going to put roots down
there.
Yeah, it
was like, you know, a summer internship.
Gotcha.
I did line up an internship with a pharmacy while I was out there. So all my boxes were checked and my, you know, responsibility brain, you know, I was like, okay, I've got some income coming in. I'm fulfilling my requirements for pharmacy school. I get to see what happens with this boy, and it's an adventure. So my family, they were a little concerned, but they knew I was coming back, or at least they thought so. I was pretty responsible, I would say. And so I don't think they were so concerned, but I think they were excited for me because I was coming back.
So what happened at the end of the summer?
Well, I did come back. I had to come back to finish my last year of pharmacy school, but then the bug had bit me. So the rest of pharmacy school was basically like this crazy, I'm going to make movies adventure in pharmacy school.
Wow.
All of my research projects became video projects, and my internship projects, when I would go off and do work where I'd had to do like these final projects for places, like I went back home and did a retail pharmacy internship. And instead of writing a report and a paper about my experience, I did two commercials for him for the local cable, you know, for the local cable system. And that's how I navigated that world from there on out, was I tried to bring this new passion that I had into that world. They all thought I was a bit nuts, but it ended up working out. And in fact, I ended up going to graduate school at Auburn University in pharmacy administration, of all things, with my new passion in filmmaking. But the dean of pharmacy school at UNC had just come from Auburn, and he knew that they were doing a lot of production work. They had a full-fledged studio with all of these cameras and equipment that was funded by the United States Pharmacopeia to do this visualized drug database. And they were doing this work in this way that he thought that maybe could combine my two brains, my right brain and my left brain.
Gotcha.
And so he sent me down there, and sure enough, I just kept making TV. So it was a good move.
Well, it sounds like it was a great equation to match these two, I guess, passions together.
It was a good, safe way for me to enter this world, because never in a million years would I have even thought it was a possibility. You know, making TV coming from Peekskill, North Carolina, never would I have thought of that as being a career opportunity for me.
You finished at Auburn, and then what happened?
I ended up moving to New York City.
You came here without a job?
I did, but again, there was a boy involved. So it was a little bit easier, an easier move, but I ended up working at a post-production facility there that the guy that I ended up marrying him, he owned this company.
Well, that's convenient.
Yeah, it was convenient. And but I did love him. He was a really great guy. And it gave me the opportunity to really learn a lot more.
Sure.
He was one of the first houses that had Avid systems. And so I learned early on Avid editing and things like that. So I was able to learn all these skills and turn into a filmmaker, which, you know, it took me a long time to actually call myself a filmmaker because I really didn't feel like I was. You know, I didn't have any formal training. I never went to any classes or courses or anything that taught me any of this, you know, even how to tell a story. You know, all of it that I've done has been instinctual and just learning on the job. So I've finally, I think, I've embraced the ability to call myself a filmmaker and an artist, but it took a long time.
You know, I've interviewed a lot of women who are filmmakers, and it's still, even in 2017, there are still not a whole lot of you. And I kind of can't imagine, even though you weren't getting tremendous experience and training, what you thought for yourself for the future, not having a whole lot of role models.
The gender thing has not been one of those things that I have fixated on in the sense of thinking that it was something that was holding me back. You know, I think regionalism has been a bigger problem for me than being a female. You know, clearly it is a problem and it is an issue. And I think I recognize it even more the older that I get, and I get furious about it. But what I've always done, though, and I think that this is why I've been able to succeed, is I've created my own work. I have never depended on somebody else to hire me for anything. And so that's why I have been able to continue, is because I hire myself.
Gotcha.
And I create my own work.
So did you give birth to any of your own projects while in New York, or you left the city?
Yeah, Tobacco Money Feeds My Family was my very first film. And that was the one where I learned everything on that project. And that was that I started that project when I was in New York. And I was coming back to North Carolina quite frequently. And it took 3 years to film it and another 2 years to edit that film. And it was it was like birthing a baby for sure.
Wow. What is amazing about that, or maybe not, I don't know, as I sit here kind of, you know, with a little jaw-dropping action going on, your first documentary gets aired on PBS. I mean, that's no small potatoes, kiddo.
No. And I still think to this day it was probably one of my best films, because it was coming from this place deep inside of me where I knew that story had to come out.
Talk to me about this story.
Growing up on a tobacco farm, or growing up around tobacco farms, and it's just a part of your life, and it's how we all made money. It's, you know, just was ingrained in us. And we didn't think of ourselves as evil. We were just making a living. Huh. Been doing that for so long, and it just was a part of us and our community. And so, you know, I move away from Pink Hill, my hometown, and I start getting this vibe that tobacco farming is bad. You know, I knew, you know, smoking was bad for you, but, you know, just I'd always been able to separate the actual cultivation of the product and the final product from each other.
Right.
You know, it was sort of like different. And when I ended up moving to New York, and I would tell people about my background and, you know, what I did every summer growing up, they're like, ah, you know, tobacco farmers are evil. And how could they do that? How could they grow something that kills people? Mm-hmm. And so making that film was something that was important for me to be able to tell people about us, you know, about my community and about my family and about, you know, why we would grow something that kills people. You know, we don't consider it that, you know, it's just what we know. And just stopping something cold turkey that is the lifeblood of your community is not an easy task. And holding that over a whole region of people was something that I felt like that was unfair without being able to offer some solutions. It was always, you've got to just stop growing tobacco. But what are we going to do to feed our families if we do that? You know, there's not a lot else that you can do, you know, especially with that kind of crop, because it was one of the few things that would actually feed a family. If you were growing 20 acres of tobacco, you could do that. You could feed your family off of that.
So this is a very personal film for you. And were you surprised that your first venture landed on television?
You hope for great things, especially when you put so much of your time and so much of your who you are on screen like that.
Right.
I mean, it's you're so vulnerable in that process, and you want people to accept the project because it's you. And then it is really personal if you get rejected. Now, I got so many rejections from grant proposals and things like that. I used to have a folder just with rejection letters in them.
So where did the money come from for making this movie?
I got funding from foundations here in North Carolina, mostly, I would say. Those were the folks that understood the value of doing something like this. So it was one of those things where if I had not gotten success early on, I don't know if I would have actually headed down this path the way I had headed. So I feel like a lot of these things and a lot of things that have happened in my life, it's like, you know, if certain things had not have happened, I would not be where I am.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of those things. But ending up on PBS, it was a perfect home for it. And they really saw why a story like that was also valuable. And I've also noticed too that, you know, PBS, that's the reason why a lot of my projects end up on PBS, is that other outlets have not seen a value in telling these kinds of regional stories. They have been called local stories, and local with a little L is what I have said, but I'm telling local stories with a big L, and they do resonate beyond this region. And, you know, the proof is that people watch it and they tell me. So that part has been really frustrating as I've moved forward in my career, is still making content that is here and based in my community, and having heads of networks telling me that they don't see how they're going to get an audience to watch this because it's, you know, based in North Carolina.
Well, that's
like
crazy.
People watch stuff about New York all the time and they're not in New York.
Of course. What's
different?
Of course. Well, North Carolina is not sexy.
But the interesting thing is it has become a little more sexy. Like the South has become one of those things where now I'm like, the pendulum has swung and I'm pissed off about this, that, you know, we're exotic.
So you have this thread, because then comes the guest worker, which is about migrant farm workers in North Carolina, and then the sit-ins from the 60s, which is, you know, a history lesson. And then you kind of veer away from that, in a sense, to make a chef's life. Can you talk about the genesis of that, which turned into your first television series?
Vivian, who is the chef in the series and the host and my partner on the project, she and I grew up together. She had this desire to tell stories about dying foodways in our community, you know, making sauerkraut like my grandma would do and her grandma would do, and all these things that we grew up and really treasured those memories, but we saw that folks weren't doing that kind of stuff anymore. So we had this notion of telling the story of our food ways. And then I started spending some time with her, and her story was fascinating. And I started seeing her as the conduit to be able to tell that story of food ways and our agricultural community, but through her lens of coming back home from New York City and opening up this high-end farm-to-fork restaurant before farm-to-fork was fashionable. And that story in and of itself had a lot of merit, of her coming in and making this restaurant successful in this remote area of our state that had no business, you know, really having that kind of restaurant and having that success. And so it was her and her husband that were pushing this. And so we talked about framing this story of Foodways through her and her life and her restaurant and her struggles. And initially, she had just had, when we started filming, she had just had twins. Oy. And she was 3 months post giving birth. And we were out there filming, and I told her that this was a test film, you know, session, that it was not really for real. And she's wearing one of her old maternity dresses. She has like a milk stain on it and all kinds of stuff. Not glamorous at all. And that ends up, that footage ends up in the very first episode of A Chef's Life. And she's like, I'm going to kill you. But, you know, that's starting that way and trying to figure out how to tell a story about food that is about cooking, but it's not really about cooking, that's really based in documentary and, you know, the techniques of just kind of following your characters and seeing what evolves. I mean, it was something that was new for me and, you know, definitely new for her. And trying to figure out, like, what's the formula for something like that? You know, I watched a little bit of the Food Network for a little while, trying to figure out what was up with cooking shows, and nothing was appealing to me, really. You know, I was like, okay, I don't really quite get it, but, you know, I'll go out there and we'll do like a cooking demo or something in the middle of one of these episodes. And so we struggled a little bit the first couple of episodes trying to figure out, like, how to conform to something that would be accepted as TV content, but also being true to what my vision is and then what her vision is to wanting to tell these stories. And so we ended up just sort of bagging the demo parts of it and just made it a docuseries. So it's, you know, we do talk about food, so it is still considered a food show, but it's just more of a documentary series.
I think that's amazing that you just kind of went with this flow. And that how it morphed into something that you probably never dreamed would turn into this television series.
Yeah. I mean, we have 4 million viewers per episode.
Oh, that's nuts. So, oh, that's fabulous. And it's just going to keep on keeping on, right?
I tell her she's a legit celebrity now. She is. So we'll go through the airport and people recognize her and want to take pictures with her. They even recognize her voice from around the corner if she's laughing. And I just get a kick out of that.
So this is open-ended.
Yeah, we just had a meeting at PBS headquarters last week talking about some new ideas and things like that. So,
oh, that's fabulous.
They're very supportive, and they see that Vivian in the show is a real asset for the PBS system. And we're doing what I think their mission is. You know, we're out there telling stories about different regions and different kinds of people and exposing that and, you know, in a way that is respectful, and, you know, that our differences are embraced instead of, you know, showing them as, you know, exotic. So I feel as though that we totally align with the PBS mission with that show, and it's nice to have them as a home. And I don't think we wouldn't have had a home if they hadn't embraced us, because we had shopped the idea around and no one
fell on deaf ears.
Yeah, no one was interested. Vivian was an unknown. The format was completely wonky because it's not a cooking show. It's not a documentary. You know, it's all those things that I've experienced through this career, is that we're just doing what we feel instinctually is right.
And so, but it's working. However, we're going to point the car in this direction now. The Road to Race Day, about NASCAR, which is, its home is North Carolina. What made you decide to go in that direction?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. I have this list, like my top tier things in the South that I would love to tackle. And NASCAR has been on that list for a really long time. And one is because it is hyper-masculine, and feeling as though that, you know, I didn't completely understand that world. You know, I grew up on my granddaddy's knee watching NASCAR on Sundays after church, and he was a Richard Petty fan. So I was familiar with that world. And if you're in the South, you feel like it's a part of your DNA. You just can't help it. Even if you're not necessarily a fan and not going to races, it's just so, you know, it permeates everything around here. And so it felt like one of those worlds that I knew, but I didn't really know at all. And so I've just been really curious about it. And, you know, every now and then my producing partner, Melinda Lowry, you know, we sit at a bar and we drink whiskey.
Well, that's where it all began, woman.
Yeah. You know? And we talk about, like, what else do we want to do? Like, what's on the list of things that we haven't tackled? Are we, you know, where do we want to go next? And so NASCAR is always like, you know, well, we should really think about this. And so we had this opening to make contact with Hendrick Motorsports, and they are the creme de la creme of the sport. You know, they have four cup teams, and Jimmy Johnson, Dale Earnhardt Jr., who is still the most popular driver, he's one of their drivers. Casey Kane and Chase Elliott was coming in this year that we filmed, and he was taking over Jeff Gordon's car, and he's the son of Bill Elliott, who is a legend in the sport. And so, you know, just being able to even say hey to them was one of those things, like, hey, you know, we're going to throw it out there and just see if they're interested, but I'm sure they're not going to be. But we sent a couple of notes, and they were familiar with my work, and they said, yeah, come in and let's talk about it. What's your idea? And so we went in and we presented a concept that would focus mostly on Chase Elliott, because he was getting into the car and starting out as a 20-year-old with this team that was a veteran team that had seen lots of wins with Jeff Gordon. And we thought that it would be a nice story to follow this young guy around in the sport. So Hendrick was open to the idea. And that was like a huge shock to us, because, you know, they were, you know, they had all the mega stars, and we weren't really thinking that they would say maybe. You know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And lo and behold, when we continued with the conversations, they were like, hey, we've got these other three drivers like Jimmy Johnson and Junior, would you want to film them as well? So they basically opened up the whole team to all, you know, all the other cars and all the other teams to let us have access. But I think really what the key to them agreeing was that the work that we have done has not been sensational. It really has been looking at the South and looking at people in this way where it is, we're interested in what people do and what people have to say. And when we enter their environment, it is with a ton of respect and a ton of curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going into a world with a gotcha kind of attitude, which I feel as though that's maybe one of the fears that they had, or they were afraid that it was, you know, a lot of proposals that they have been more in the reality TV world, you know, Wives of NASCAR kinds of content. And they haven't been interested in doing anything like that.
Trust factor had to be huge.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And obviously, like you said, your past spoke for itself. And so they opened up their vaults for you, so to speak.
Yeah. Towards the end, we had our own key card to get into their facility. And this place is super secret. Just us being there to begin with cameras and having access to some of these areas is completely unheard of. And then us being able to freely roam around their facility and pop in wherever we wanted to pop in to film is just, you know, at the beginning would have been ridiculous for me to have even suggested that they let us do that. But the longer we were there, the more comfortable they were with us being there and the more access that they allowed us to have.
How long was filming?
We filmed for about 6 months. We focused on a race for each episode, and we filmed two episodes with each team. And so that allowed us to kind of to get some diversity in the kinds of tracks that we ended up, and also the parts of the country where we would film to. We ended up in Sonoma for one race, which that was really nice to be able to see a different kind of race track and a different area of the country that also has racing fans.
I'm curious as to where you're headed next.
Oh, good question. Well, we're still filming with Vivian on A Chef's Life, so we'll do that for a while. But I don't know. I'm really grappling with that, trying to figure out ways that I want to grow. I have this itching to do narrative work, but again, you know, I don't have opportunities that are thrown my way. So I'll probably have to create an opportunity for.
Well, you seem to have done okay with that in the past, Cynthia.
Yeah, it's true. So I don't know if there's a reason to switch up now. Hmm. I think maybe we just continue on this path of drumming up our own work and our own way of doing things. And it sort of fits me because I'm kind of stubborn, and I don't like being told what to do. So it's probably best that I do my own work.
Well, it's worked for you, and that's the best part of it.
Yeah, it's true. You know, you can tell that there's a lot of passion that goes into these projects. And, you know, it may not seem like an obvious jump to go from a film about domestic violence to a cooking show, you know, with one of my best friends from Eastern North Carolina, to a series about NASCAR and the hypermasculine world of stock car racing. But to me, it all makes sense.
Well, if nothing else, I think it's really exciting that you put Pink Hill, North Carolina on the map. It's a wonderful to meet women like you who just do not unorthodox things, but kind of have the grit and determination to be able to live the way you want to live and share what you want to share.
There comes a lot of sacrifices with that, I feel like, but it's so far it's been worth it.
Well, I'm sure that no road is so necessarily easy to hoe, but you certainly have all your street cred here. And I think it's just really exciting. And I guess I got to get myself down to North Carolina, although I have been.
Well, I can take you to eat, and I can also take you to a stock car race. So.
Well, then, I mean, there's no reason to go on living after that. That sounds like a great plan. Thank you so much, Cynthia Hill, for joining me today. And it's been
my pleasure.
To get to know you and to get to know your work. And I think it's just incredibly exciting.
I appreciate it.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.